You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
Welcome, everyone. I have a couple of very quick remarks I'm going to read for the radio, but then I'm going to ad lib it because I really love this book and I just want to talk about it for a moment. Hi, everyone. Welcome to tonight's conversation at Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Barry Eisler, a novelist, blogger, and former CIA. I'm excited to be speaking with the author and illustrator of the graphic novel Verax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. Author Prothap Chatterjee is an investigative reporter on U.S. warfare and technology, a popular television commentator, journalist for outlets including The New Republic, The Financial Times, and The Guardian. Illustrator Khalil Bendib is a former political cartoonist for the San Bernardino Sun, the co-author of the New York Times bestseller Zahra's Paradise, and co-host of the podcast Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. The universe of mass surveillance, drones, whistleblowers, and espionage is a complex one, and Prothap and Khalil have taken history, stories, and more, and leveraged illustration to even more fully engage the reader. So I have to say, this is the fourth, maybe fifth, Commonwealth Club event I've moderated, and the truth is I don't always have time to read the whole book that is under discussion. I always spend a lot of time familiarizing myself with it. I want to do a good job as a moderator, but time is tight. Sometimes I'm under a deadline, and I don't always get to read the whole thing. Well, the moderator sent me my copy of Verax back in September, and I didn't really know what to expect. I'm reasonably familiar with the topic of whistleblowers and mass surveillance, but I just didn't know how one would tell this story in a graphic novel. And in my mind, I was thinking this was going to be fiction because the graphic novels I know are fictitious. I started reading this and I was like, oh, Julian Assange. Oh, that's cool that they wove him in there. And then someone who's in the audience tonight, Lisa Ling, a whistleblower. And then Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. And I was like, this isn't fiction. So I'm a little slow on the uptake, but I couldn't put it down. It reads like a thriller, and take my word for it because I write thrillers for a living. It's just a terrific book. I loved it. And so, guys, I'm so excited to be here with you tonight and getting to talk with you about it. First question, I know it's the most obvious. Why a graphic novel? Laura Poitras made an Oscar-winning documentary. You've got Glenn Greenwald's book, Nowhere, Citizen Four. You've got Glenn Greenwald's book, Nowhere to Hide. Oliver Stone made a biopic about Snowden. The story's been told in various formats. As far as I know, this is the only graphic novel telling of the incredibly important and relevant story of mass surveillance in America and all over the world today. Why a graphic novel?
Well, we started before them, but we were so slow that we finished after them. So they beat us to the punch. All of them.
I'm glad no one else overtook you.
Oliver Stone beat us. Laura Poitras beat us. Everybody
It just
did.
Shows you that a graphic novel
it's
takes a lot of love
fault.
And care.
It's mostly my fault because I'm so slow. But this was also a very complex operation. I came up with the idea originally when Snowden came up with his revelations in June 2013. I had finished a previous graphic novel by the name of Zahra's Paradise, which was a New York Times bestseller. It was in 16 languages, and I wanted to continue with something just as exciting. And I was focused on whistleblowers. I was really inspired by them. Chelsea Manning used to be Bradley Manning. I, at some point, was thinking I'm going to do a graphic novel about him back then. Didn't happen, but when Snowden finally revealed all the stuff that he did, I thought, I know what I'm going to call. I'm going to call Prothap Chatterjee, whose beat I know this is. Prothap, I've been working with Prothap for many years on mostly political cartoons. But I knew that he was following this track, this mass surveillance, drone warfare and all that, that he knew people like Julian Assange, Laura Poitras. So I gave him a call, and he accepted. So we decided to do this together.
It was actually very interesting for me because even though, of course, as a child, like any child, I read comic books, I've never written a graphic novel before. So I had to learn how to do it. And I discovered it was actually like writing a thriller, a movie, or a play, actually, which I was familiar with. However, it's a lot harder because you have to squeeze real life into it. And real life is more complicated than... You know, it doesn't have clear beginnings. It doesn't have clear ends. Yeah. The beginning of the book actually was written long after we started. The middle of the book is the beginning of the book. And then we also, the other problem with this is it was unfolding in real time. So every week I would come back. We met every Wednesday afternoon. I'd be like, guess what happened? And clearly, like, we can't put that in. But we actually carried, the book actually ends in March of 2017. So it includes Trump,
right,
who threw us for a loop. We were like, well, what is he going to do about drone wars?
Right.
Is he stop him? Is he going to ramp him up? And we addressed that in the book.
Yeah, probably not.
And so I had to train Pratap a little bit in the graphic novel 101 thing, because he hadn't read or even thought about graphic novels before. He'd read comics when he was a kid. Graphic novels he wasn't familiar with.
I'm the same way. I mean, I've read graphic novels. I've read, you know, The Sandman and V for Vendetta.
Yeah.
I know the format, but if somebody were to say to me, Barry, you know a decent amount about mass surveillance and whistleblowers, write a graphic novel, I just wouldn't even know how to go about it, which is part of why I was so fascinated by this book, because it's a huge story. And yet somehow you tell it in such a, on the one hand, concise, but at the same time, really compelling and comprehensive way. I was, like I said, I had a hard time putting it down.
We can blame Maus and Persepolis and Joe Sacco for this, because they together started this new fangled genre.
Yeah.
Really, before Maus, I think there wasn't the term of graphic novels. I grew up reading comic strips, just fantastic work by, you know, wasn't just for kids back in Europe. But the graphic novel, really, as a genre, more literary, not necessarily all done by fantastic artists.
Right.
But people are good enough, clever enough to draw the stuff and write at the same time. And finally, after those two blockbusters, Maus, first of all, which got the Pulitzer Prize, and then Persepolis, which also went worldwide, was extremely popular. Joe Sacco happened. This guy in Portland, Oregon.
I don't know the name.
His name is Joe Sacco. He invented a new genre within that genre, which is now known as graphic journalism
or comics journalism.
Right.
And nobody had thought about it before, certainly not I. I was thinking, you know, what does journalism have to do with comics?
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost two opposites, right?
Yeah.
One is concerned with accuracy and all that. Comics could be about humor, it could be fantasy, poetry, all you want.
That was always my impression, too.
Exactly. But this guy kind of brought the two together in a book called Palestine, then another one, Gorazde, Bosnia.
He's not allowed writing about Bosnia.
Really serious stuff. And a little bit like we did here, which is recount what was happening in those countries. He would go there and do journalism in comics form. So he opened up a wide new door for people like us. And I thought, hey, I'll try the first one. My first one, Tsar's Paradise, was fiction. But this one had to be nonfiction.
Right.
That's why I called on Pratap.
So it's funny, in retrospect, it seems... You did such a great job with this that I come away from it feeling like, God, isn't it obvious? A graphic novel is a perfect format to tell a story like this because you told it so well. There are so many characters, there are so many interlocking pieces that to try to go deep on every single one, particularly if you only have text as your medium, I think it would be overwhelming. It could be sprawling. Whereas here, you really knit everything up nicely. And Pratap, I'd like to hear a little bit more about the different pieces you saw as a journalist for this story. Obviously, there are the whistleblowers, but then there's a corporate angle, obviously government. How do you see the whole mosaic surveillance?
Sure. I work for a nonprofit called CorpWatch. And so we follow, and the work I was doing with Julian Assange is looking at surveillance contractors, companies who are in the business of selling technology to hack your phone, to track you, and that sort of thing. So this is a subject I knew about. I was also interested in drones, and I wanted to investigate it.
So you started more with the corporate angle.
I did.
Corporations that make this sort of tracking technology.
Exactly. And there was a seminal event, which the book opens with, where I go with a group, with a nonprofit called Reprieve, to Pakistan, and I meet all these relatives of people who have been killed in drone strikes. And one of the people I meet and I film, 3 days later, is killed by the CIA. And the CIA even acknowledged it to the Washington Post. So I thought I needed to get to the bottom of this technology. And it's not easy. Most people think, you know, technology is magic, right? We all believe that, you know, my phone can get me places, and therefore, surely, it can find terrorists. Well, actually, that's not true at all. And so I dug deeper and deeper and deeper, and so I had to go talk to engineers. And then I had to talk to people in the military, because this book, Virax, just in case you didn't know what the word means, it's Latin for truth-teller. It's one of the code names that Snowden, Edward Snowden, used when he talked to the Washington Post. And we thought that really kind of summed up our book, because it's about whistleblowers. It's about people who work for the government, who work for the military, and who want to tell actually tell people what's wrong. And in fact, I want to call somebody out in the audience. One of the people in the book is actually right here, Lisa Ling.
Yes. Yes.
She's a veteran of the U.S. military, and was there for 20 years, and then she blew the whistle and talked about how drones were killing people. So, to me, I just had to tell their stories in some ways, yeah. And so, as you know, a good story is generally told through the medium of people. And so we used people. And, of course, the advantage of having a cartoonist is you can illustrate them and you can draw things. We had a lot of fun, you know, drawing an elephant and saying, you know, this is like a, you know, the people in intelligence are like blind men who are trying to explore an elephant, right? And so they feel the elephant and they feel a ear and they feel a trunk.
Sure.
And they don't know what it is. And when you get that each of the things that they are looking at are different and they don't show the whole picture,
right,
you start to understand, you know, why this is a problem.
Right.
And so this is what we sought to explain. I think I've lost trace of your question.
No, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. So Prothap, you're a character in the book. And so
much to my...
my fault.
I didn't want to be in the book.
No.
I thought it could be an object of fun, perhaps.
I loved it. I thought it worked so well. We all just met tonight. These guys know each other.
Right. We know each other very well.
But this is the first night I met these two gentlemen. And so I feel like I got to know you as a character in the book. And you are a central character in the story, trying to track these things down, often over your editor's objections or on interest. Why do you think there is not more interest among editors in big news corporations about what I would consider to be one of the most important stories in the world?
So I'll tell you, I work with a lot of journalists because I'm somebody who works with non-NGOs and I follow detailed stories. Reporters often call me up and say, hey, something just broke in the news. What do you know about this? Or do you have any good ideas? And I'll send stories their way. And sometimes, you know, it's on the front page of the LA Times, the New York Times. But I remember writing about a company called L3. It's in New York. Mm-hmm. And they're a big intelligence contract. And I told a reporter of the New York Times about it. And he went with it. His name is Scott Shane. He's a very famous journalist. He thought it was a good story because it explained how this company got the contract to interrogate people in Guantanamo. Right. And then his editor said to him, dead bodies? Are there any dead bodies, smoking guns? We only care if, you know, there's some kind of major conflict,
yeah,
right? And so, interestingly, the book wasn't about drones to begin with, and this is actually how I came in. The book was about Edward Snowden.
Mm.
And then as we wrote it and Khalil convinced me to be in it, I was like, well, I actually don't know Edward Snowden. So if you want to talk about my story,
right,
you have to talk about a much bigger picture. And he's like, well, that's really important.
Yeah.
And Snowden alludes to it. You know, he says, the reason I care about mass surveillance is because it's used to kill people. But he doesn't go any further. And this book, we hope, will tell people how mass surveillance is used to kill people.
Right.
Yeah, the book for me, as the title indicates, was about truth tellers.
Yeah.
That's what really excited me. There are people courageous enough to devote their lives to it. I mean,
yeah,
at the cost, of great cost, personal cost,
oh, yes,
to their families, to their freedom.
Yeah.
That's what really motivated me to do the book. I really admire and I'm inspired by these people. But halfway through the book, we decided, look, it can't just be about... We need to open it up to the second half of our exploration here, which is your job, your work, your beat, which is the drones, because we all know by now, thanks to Snowden and people like that, that there's a problem of democracy when the government spies on every one of us, and they're not supposed to. They're doing it against the law. We don't know what they use it for, maybe to keep us from expressing ourselves down the line. We don't know exactly what they're doing. We're all familiar with that story by now, in large part thanks to Snowden and Poitras and Glenn Greenwald and others. But we didn't really hear about the second half, the second shoe to drop, which was they use that same technology,
right,
to actually kill people, and very often innocent people. And that's a problem. So Prothap had to step into the story because through his eyes,
Took him about 2 years to convince me.
Especially drawing him. You know, when you draw somebody, and this is my experience since I was a kid, I would draw people in my classroom, all my classmates, my teachers, and everybody to a T. Everybody would be unanimous that I was a genius when it came to drawing the others.
Right.
Absolutely perfect. Me, you didn't really, you know, I'm sorry, it's a massacre. But the others, man, just perfect. So I always have that problem dealing with people I draw, including Pratap. You know, Pratap keeps saying, I don't mind the way you're... I knew you didn't like it. He would say, draw me any way you want. But I knew that everybody would pick up the book, would go, oh, this is not me. But the others, you got just perfect. So I kind of twisted his arm a little bit, told him, you got to step into the book, and I'm going to draw you from page to page, following these important stories, meeting these important people like Lisa Ling here among us tonight.
It's funny. Yeah. It's always in retrospect. Your instinct seems so spot on to me. And I don't know if you know, but Jeremy Scahill experienced something similar when, I forgot the name of his photographer partner, Rick, I want to say Rick Rowley.
Rick Rowley, yeah.
Yeah, Rick Rowley.
I know Rick, yeah.
Rick had to persuade Jeremy to be part of the film version of Dirty Wars, and Jeremy didn't want it to be about him, but he just, I think, made a really persuasive argument, proven by the results of the great film, based on a great book, which is that we need a narrative arc built around someone. And once, it seems to me, in retrospect, everything's always so obvious in retrospect, that once you expanded the story beyond just the whistleblowers to tie it in with this drone-based killing campaign, that no one whistleblower would be the central glue for all those different elements. And so it's,
I mean,
natural.
I would take me out of it and actually see it as a journalist. Uh-huh. You know, there are many journalists and they have a hard job convincing their editors, and they run into roadblocks all the time. People won't talk to them, you know, companies won't return their calls. So we really did try to actually inject that idea of what it is like to be a journalist.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and there, you know, there's often a lot of debate. Some people call Julian Assange a whistleblower, some call him a traitor, and some call him a journalist. But he really actually is a journalist. You may not agree with him, but his job is getting documents to the public, and that's our job too.
Right.
So we're just a window in some ways. And I also think it's a little, the New York Times always does this thing about saying a reporter witnessed when, you know, damn it, say that it's you. You know, say you, because it's your
so nice to hear that.
You, right?
Yeah.
And you may not have seen the whole thing. So if you say, and you're honest about it, and you say, this is my perspective and my opinion, which skews it, you know, people will be refreshed by that. Otherwise, they just assume it's true. And then when they find it's not true, you know, it's a problem.
I love hearing that. It's a pet peeve of mine. I hate the phrase, this journalist. I'm like, oh, you mean I? You. Keep going. And because it's this really, I know it's become a custom, but to me it's this, it's an attempt to make something that is inherently subjective seem more objective, and I just find it irritating. Somebody wrote the story. Somebody witnessed the event. That's a human being. We tend to refer to ourselves in the first person unless we have really high notions of ourselves. We say, like, Donald J. Trump hereby bans all my... That's a really bad sign when people start talking about themselves in the third person. But, yeah, we say I, so just say I. Don't pretend.
He is president. Maybe we should do the same. I'm just kidding.
So I love the sweep of the story. I love how you anchor it as a journalist, tying together what you're learning from whistleblowers and at trade shows where all these corporations are out there. Obviously, the drone program itself should be of great concern to anyone with even minimal empathy, I think, or humanitarian instinct. And yet, a lot of people don't really seem to care very much. What do you see as the most important parts of the overall story, the most important implications of the story? In other words, why should the average person be concerned about mass surveillance in the 21st century?
Well, as you said, even for people with minimal empathy who are under the general impression that, you know, the drone war is not so bad because we're not exposing our people
right there.
I mean, we can kill people from a distance and forget about it. It's actually not true, as we document in the book. A lot of people who do push the button suffer a lot, but PTSD, the remorse, they can't stand it. You know, killing people that they've observed for days and weeks and just killing them It's not as easy as it seems.
Right.
And ultimately, blowback. You know, when we think that, like we did before 2001, that we can get away with murder, unfortunately, it can come back to haunt us. Blowback should be a serious concern for all of us. If we are not able to empathize with innocent people on the other side of the world getting killed for no reason.
I've never understood why so many people seem to have trouble understanding that. And when I try to explain it, I say, what happened in America on 9/11 and afterwards? Did you see the bloodlust that gripped the country, and now it's 15 years later, and we're
17 years later, almost 16.
September 2001. 16 years later, and we're still in the grip of this fever. We've killed hundreds of thousands of innocent people because of one attack on one day. It's human. It's not necessarily a good thing, but it's how humans respond to violence with violence of their own. And I try to get people to understand that if we respond to violence with violence of our own, is it possible that other peoples elsewhere in the world, being human, will have a similar reaction to violence perpetrated on them? And it's hard to get people to understand that when it seems so axiomatic.
I think there's another important takeaway from the book, which is technology doesn't equal justice. Mm-hmm. And especially, I think it's important to say, since we're essentially in the heart of Silicon Valley, just because you've got a lot of data on people could actually lead you to jump to the wrong conclusions. And in fact, often does. There's nothing better than somebody on the ground. There's nothing better than a legal system which has checks and balances.
Right.
And this, I mean, there are JAGs, there are judge advocate generals, who have to check off to make sure you follow the rules of engagement and the spins and all these other different things. But at the end of the day, even in Guantanamo, you know, there was a system by which the prisoners had the option to speak for themselves. And in this, they don't. But if you don't mind, Barry, I actually want to turn this conversation around a little, because you worked for the CIA. And I know it was before 9/11, it was before smartphones, but I think the mindset is probably still not that different. This isn't just about the CIA, by the way. It is also about the Pentagon, the military, the Air Force. So what do you think of, I mean, the mindset when you were there? You were there for 3 years, right?
This would be a, I mean, I'll make it really brief because it's its own conversation, I think. But when I was there, I don't think mass surveillance was particularly a thing. It was pre-internet. This is 1989 to 92. there is a mindset at CIA. It may surprise you to know that most CIA people, at least the ones I knew, are socially liberal. They'd fit right in San Francisco. But in terms of the empire and the notion that America has a responsibility to beneficently gift other countries with order and freedom via our bombs, that's very much a CIA mindset. And it's really neither left nor right, which is part of the reason it interests me so much. And that's all I'm going to say for now, because it's an interesting topic, and I'd love to talk about it more. But I know everybody's here to hear from you guys, and I know I am too. Khalid, you were saying a second ago, reasons we should be concerned about this whole program. Basic, minimal human empathy for innocent people being killed. And by the way, you guys lay this out so beautifully in the book. It's like it's not magic technology. This is how innocent people get killed all the time. Thousands of innocent people. And then, okay, oh, really? You don't have any empathy? Okay, how about some self-regard? Are you concerned about blowback? Because people tend to respond to violence with violence of their own. What other things should people be concerned about? What do you make of it when people say, well, surveillance, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear?
Exactly. I think Daniel Ellsberg makes that point very well. He says, if you think that you're immune because you don't feel guilty of anything, you've got another thing coming, because they can spy on you. They can find that little thing that you would rather keep private.
Yes.
And use it against you, and blackmail the congressman, and blackmail the whoever, the governor, or blackmail you in what you're trying to do. If you believe in a cause, you believe in, you're pro-life, you believe in that passionately, and they consider that subversive, God knows what they can do with the information they have on you, and on. So it's really a very anti-democratic impulse. On the part of some of these people who are at the top of these agencies, to somehow convince us that it's completely benign, it's just here to protect us. the big brother watching me doesn't reassure me at all.
Same. And a lot of people haven't read 1984 in a while. And so they think like, yeah, but, you know, the telescreens, they weren't on all the time. So, you know, like, they're not always watching you. But the point of 1984 is the point of the panopticon, which is you never know when you're being watched. You might be, or maybe you're not. And what happens as a result, there was, not that we needed it, but there are all sorts of scientific experiments to prove this. People self-censor. You start acting a little different. Glenn Greenwald has a great thought experiment when people doubt this. He says, look, imagine you're at a dinner party and everyone's had a couple of glasses of wine and the conversation is flowing very, very freely. And Glenn says, I just think this is such an interesting conversation. I just want to put this dictaphone on the table and just record everything that everyone's saying so I can listen to it later or whatever. Oh, keep going. Sorry for interrupting. What happens to the free flow of that conversation? We all know what happens. You didn't really need all the experiments that have been done to bear it out. But people just don't think this way. And I hope they will after reading the book. I know you had some images that you wanted to share with the audience.
Sure.
And
sure, we have.
I want to make sure you have time
like
to do
share.
That.
How long do we have, Marisa? 15 minutes. Okay, great. So we'll just show some of the pages. We'll start with the...
Point it that way.
Point that way, okay.
Toward the back corner.
Back there, okay. That's so we'll start with a few pages of the prologue. It just shows you... No, it's not doing it.
That's how you know you work for a nonprofit.
That's because I'm a Luddite.
But perhaps
so
if we gave
know
you
that
the
I'm a Luddite and they don't like me. It's mutual. I don't like them. They don't like me.
That's why when I give book talks and they ask if I'm going to do any AV, I always say.
Okay, one
sure.
more
yeah.
question.
So you started with Snowden was the inspiration for the
yes.
book. And why? Did you read the Guardian articles? This is June 2013?
Yeah, it was all over all the media, so I couldn't miss it for a while. And
yeah.
That was wonderful. It felt almost miraculous. It felt like I wish it could be like this all the time, and the government really embarrassed. So here are some of the images. So we start with somewhere in Central Asia. There's a drone that's called the Predator going over this mountain in Afghanistan. Then we see these kids playing soccer, worried about it. There's this baby crying because the constant noise of the Predator drives people crazy. Earlier today, Pratap, you were saying how it sounds like a lawnmower.
Right.
And it's constant. And the worst part of it is that the lawnmower is not supposed to kill you at some point, and you don't even know that you're going to be killed. And so it's a terrible... in position, people go crazy.
There's an Amnesty report, really great report, it's called Will I Be Next? And it's really from the perspective of people living under drones. So there's PTSD,
which I think you guys do beautifully in this opening sequence.
So here we see the other side of it, in Nevada yeah. somewhere maybe, looking at these kids playing ball and looking at this guy there whose baby's crying. And then we see a whole bunch of people watching the same images. Here it's Creech. Nevada, you want to take it for them?
Sure. So we want to actually illustrate, this is actually not in the audits in the book, just so you know, but we want to illustrate what actually happens when drone personnel target and kill people. This is an interesting and real incident. It's the only incident for which we have an entire transcript of soldiers watching people on the ground, assuming they were terrorists, and then firing a missile to kill them, only to realize literally a minute later, and I kid you not, you can read the transcript, they realize they've killed civilians because women get out and they start waving white handkerchiefs in the sky, white scarves in the sky. And so to us, it became really important to illustrate this. Of course, you know, we don't know what the actual soldiers look like, But
this the actual transcript, this is exactly what they were saying.
It speaks for itself. Mm. This is actually what they say to each other when they kill civilians. They know that, in fact, they're making a mistake. For just a second, I've actually made a presentation. I have another report, which is very technical, called Drone Inc., which gets into the engineering of this. And I present it to people in D.C., including people who are on the National Security Council, people who work with people in the Pentagon, people from the Pentagon. And they say, well, we know it doesn't work. But the politicians, they need a solution. They need to convince people they're fighting terrorism. So even the military commanders and a lot of the soldiers know that this doesn't work, and they, because they see it every day.
And here we see my version of Pratap.
I think it's a great version.
He was a little younger. This was 5-6 years ago. 10 years ago. Anyway, so here he is at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and confronting his editor, who will end up firing him at some point because he can...
Laying me off, shall we say. Right.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
Here's is that
nice? Assange.
Yeah. Assange telling the whole group of journalists, including Pratap, which we'll see on the next page, telling about the Arab Spring, how that relates to the technology. This is... the Milpol show, the annual show in Paris that happens, it's called Milpol. It's about military and police technologies.
Correct, yeah. So every year, there's actually a bunch of these conferences. Companies get together to sell technology to what they call law enforcement agencies. So this is everybody from Egypt to Syria to
Saudi Arabia
and to the United States, etc. These are mostly companies in the Western world, in France, in Germany, in the United States. So I went to these conferences to meet these guys and say, so what do? How do you track people's phones? And they were actually quite open about it. So because from their perspective, this was about selling technology to catch. The way they would phrase it is, you don't want murderers on the loose. You don't want child pornographers on the loose. You know, we are only going to sell it to agencies that have warrants that do this lawfully. But of course, that's not our problem. It's their problem, right? So... do you trust your government? But here we go.
This close right to just saying, think of the children.
Here we have four of the whistleblowers and a gentleman from Yemen who came all the way to this country to complain about what happened to his nephew during a wedding. This is the some of the episode where Snowden, when he was cooped up in that hotel room in Hong Kong.
If you've seen Citizen 4, you'll know this.
Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras in the thick of the action. This is the suspense that leads to the publication.
I mean, an important thing about this is that story was almost not published because a lot, the Washington Post, for example, which is where Snowden first took his information, decided to, you know, confront him with lawyers and bury the story, and he got really frustrated, and then he went to Laura. And even The Guardian was a little worried about publishing this. And, you know, the CIA, the FBI, there's a scene where, the top lawyers from each of these agencies says, you cannot publish this, you know, give us a couple of weeks, come meet with us, we'll talk to you. And they're like, we're going live in an hour. And they're like, this is not a story. And they're like, well, we're journalists. We know what a story is. And we gave you your right of reply. So I think it does a really good job of explaining how difficult it is to tell these stories.
Great job. Great job.
I like this particular image because it shows, Barry will be familiar with this, the three branches of intelligence. And if you buy the book, you'll see a lot of these amazing images of, I don't know if there's the image of the elephant. You have the snake wrapping around the tree and I explained through this the history of surveillance, starting in the Second World War, all the way to Edward Snowden. And I just think the story springs to life through these pictures.
More technical explanations here from Pratap.
Again, how a drone gets information, sends it all the way to North America, and then is used seconds later to kill somebody. So it was actually, in some ways, a great story to illustrate because it's so compelling, I think, in some ways, to understand what would be very hard to explain in prose.
Yeah.
So here's the famous elephant metaphor, where five or six different people are grasping for their part of the elephant, saying this animal is very long and tall, and this and then the other one. So each one has part of the truth. It's very hard to put all of it together in a way that's cohesive, coherent, that makes sense, that's always going to be infallibly true. A lot of it gets lost in translation. A lot of people get killed for no reason, for that reason. Okay. Now, the event we remember all too well last year. It's been a very eventful year. So how is that affecting or not affecting the drone warfare?
And so we see that, like, literally a week or two after he was inaugurated, actually 2 days after he was inaugurated, he too, like Obama before him and even Bush before him, gave the go-ahead to kill people. An American soldier died in this. Many children died in this episode. It was a totally botched operation. So nothing has changed. The same surveillance continues. The same drone walk continues. And Trump has actually, many say, taken the gloves off. And I think that's probably kind of where we end.
We end with a Chelsea Manning quote. She was nice enough to provide us with a quote just in the nick of time. And we thought, oh, this is exactly what we needed.
I'll read the quote because I think it's very... It's from the perspective of somebody who's watching data flow in and whose job it is to...
And this is an image. This is the last scene of... It's the last page of a scene at Creech Air Base in Nevada where these guys are operating drones. So that's why it happens to be situated around the base here in Nevada.
And so we use this quote, which she gave to, I think, NBC, ABC News or something. She said, "We're getting all this information from all these different sources, and it's just death, oops, destruction, mayhem, and we're filtering all this through the facts, the statistics, the reports, the dates, the times, the locations, and eventually we just stopped." Mm. I stopped, speaking as herself, just seeing statistics and information and started seeing people. I have responsibility to the public. We have responsibility.
And we all have a responsibility.
And so, I mean, this is really a book about whistleblowers and a call to action, we hope, and to say that this is more important than ever in today's world, Trump or no Trump. We need to support, you know, brave, you know, public servants who come forward and speak truth to power because they can lose their job. They could be thrown in jail. They could be exiled to another country. They could even get killed.
Yeah.
So
Snowden said that his biggest fear coming forward the way he did wasn't that he would go to prison and it wasn't even that he would lose his life. It was that nobody would care.
Yeah. I think that's actually really, really important. And I think it's hard because technology is complicated and you have the government saying, trust us, you know, we have your best interests in mind. We have found terrorists and we're going to protect you. How do you dispute it? You know, you rely on the whistleblowers. You also rely on journalists who are on the ground. I was just talking to Barry before when we were in the green room about a friend of mine, Matt Aiken, who's a journalist. And he wrote a report from the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. And after he wrote that article, it was published in Harper's. It's called The Master of Spin Baldock. The head of the DIA at the time, I'll mention his name, although you'll probably ridicule me. His name is Flynn, Michael Flynn. He said to his analyst, he said, "I want you to take a look at the information we have at the CIA from this period, and I want to look at Matt Aiken's article, and I want you to compare the two, because this journalist has much more information than we do, because they're operating from such a distance, and there's nothing like being on the ground and learning from the people directly." And then you often find that you're wrong. I mean, my personal experience, I'll tell you, I've been to Afghanistan 4 times and to Pakistan 3 times and Iraq 4 times, etc. And the first time I went to Afghanistan, I thought, you know, I live in the Bay Area, I used to work for KPFA. I said, these people are going to be so angry. You know, their country is bombed, you know, to pieces. And as soon as I got there, people said, hey, you know, you got rid of Osama bin Laden. This is a great thing, you know. And I was kind of shocked. But there was one man who was in his 50s who said, you know, he said, I remember the past. And he says, I think people are very excited about the fact that the Taliban are gone, but I think things will change. And I had the same experience in Iraq where people said, wait and see. So, but you need to hear from them and hear their stories, and you have to report honestly on their stories. And I think a lot of, forget about the CIA, a lot of reporters don't do that. They report based on the press releases they get from the government. They do Google searches, and they don't go out and meet people and work on the ground.
Yeah. Lee Fang has a story today. There's a video in The Intercept where various congressmen are getting asked about the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed war in Yemen. And you probably wouldn't be surprised if you become as cynical, or call it realistic, as I am. You probably wouldn't be surprised to know that most Congress people don't really even know that there's a war going on in Yemen. They don't know. They don't know that there's mass cholera, mass starvation. They don't know about U.S. involvement. It's a strange thing to me. I would think that people would be more concerned.
I mean, I think after 16 years, people are just like, you know, injured. It's another war over there. I'm more concerned with my own job. There's a
right
fatigue.
This is why I think we should have a special surcharge collector going house to house every quarter and saying, hi, as you know, the wars are very expensive. We all have to do our part. We take checks, cash. Visa or MasterCard, and we've assessed your contribution as whatever. The wars would be over tomorrow.
Well, I have another suggestion, and I'll say this seriously. I know most people, since we're in the Bay Area, and I live here. I've lived here for 25 years. They'll probably take me out and shoot me. But I think we should bring back the draft. I think the war would be over really, really quickly. If you had to serve, if you had to actually be there, your children or your brothers and sisters, it would be very different. And I speak as somebody who spent a lot of time there myself. Yeah. I think it really changes your perspective, because I've spent literally years in the Middle East and Central Asia, not in the green zone. A lot of soldiers, in fact, don't get outside that, in the red zone. And then it really changes your perspective.
Yeah. No doubt. It's a huge experiment in moral hazard. How are we doing on time? I want to make sure the audience has. So 5 minutes before, audience questions. Okay. Thanks. So for anyone who's not familiar with the whole history of drone warfare, I would love to hear a brief recap. If I'm remembering correctly, the first lethal drone strike was conducted by none other than...
Well, George Bush.
Right.
George Bush. Well, drones themselves as a medium, it's just, you know, it's a remotely controlled plane. The people who trace the history back to the Second World War, where remotely controlled planes were sent over to Germany and that sort of thing. So it's not new.
Oh, I had a radio-controlled plane when I was in high school.
Well, there you go.
It's nothing new. No. Although,
yeah. So, I mean, the technology has existed. I think what's different about this and what people forget is the mass surveillance aspect of it. So you're using it to send information almost real time. There is a delay. It's not perfect. And then you're using it to make decisions.
Right.
And that is really problematic. So, but it becomes so easy as a politician to say, our soldiers are not in harm's way. They're here in California. There's a base. I mean, the base for the Global Hawk and the U-2, the principal base is right here. It's in Beale, you know, up in the Sierras, in the foothills of the Sierras.
But what about President Obama? He was a good liberal Democrat. So right. He wound down the drone wars, is that right?
No, not at all.
Oh, he didn't?
Not at all.
Huh.
So actually, I forget the exact count, but Obama actually had 573 drone strikes compared to Bush's 57. So he ramped it up considerably. There's a very good book by Scott Shane in which he's presented as a law lecturer. He was troubled by this idea that, you know, he didn't want to, you know, be invading countries, and he wanted a simple, elegant, legal solution. So this is what he came up with. And I think it may be, it's a good question. Only historians years from now will be able to tell whether it was his drive that that really ran this war, or whether it was actually just the engine of history, you know. People didn't want soldiers abroad. They had to find a clean, simple way that they could explain to the public.
And there is one other thing you have to take into account. I'm not trying to attack Obama or defend him. I don't really have an interest in either. The technology had improved tremendously over the course of 8 years. The tool was better developed, more widespread, easier to use. So it's a bit of an imperfect comparison to say, he certainly did do a lot more drone strikes than Bush, but in part, it's like the thing about why dogs lick their genitals. Because they can. It's because he could. Does that mean that he was more bloodthirsty than Bush? I don't know.
There's a great line by Leonard Cohen. It says, in one of his songs, he says, "We are guided by the beauty of our weapons."
Yeah.
I think it says
Peter
it so
Jennings
brilliantly.
Was quoting that
a few
recently.
Words.
Yeah.
We are guided by the beauty of our weapons.
It does seem that
way. And the belief that technology is magic.
Yes.
You know, we can trust our phones.
So with all that, what should people expect from our new president going forward? What would be a realistic expectation, assuming that Trump finishes out his term or even has 8 years? What kind of drone-killing record can we expect from the latest president?
I don't know. I like to call it the Bush-Obama-Trump administration. Really, when it comes to this sort of thing, it's really hard to discern a big change from Republican to Democrat to Republican.
Yeah.
That's my impression of it.
You know, one of the final images, we don't actually have it on the screen, is of the military-industrial complex. You know, we draw the Pentagon, we show all the different companies and technologies that are used. And so I'm reminded of the Eisenhower quote, where he talks about the military-industrial complex. And my last book was called Halliburton's Army. And everybody says, oh, well, I know about Halliburton's Army. It's about the Bush years. It's about Dick Cheney gave a contract to his best buddies. Actually, it's not. It's about a system that has existed for decades and will exist for decades in the future. So Halliburton didn't show up, you know, to benefit Dick Cheney in the invasion of Iraq. They were in Vietnam, where Donald Rumsfeld was protesting against Halliburton, what was called Brown and Root back then, getting the contract. This is a story that, you know, is profit-driven. You know, it's the companies that will make a lot of money out of it, right? It is politicians who will get reelected because they're tough and terror. So it's really important to understand that this won't end. And it's not because Obama was different from Trump or different from Bush. It is driven by the military-industrial complex, which is actually in Virginia.
Yeah. It's interesting to consider when...
and Silicon Valley.
People, yeah, very much so. When people say there's no more bipartisanship and it's all gridlock and nothing gets done.
Like, you wish.
God. Yeah, I know. I seriously... I'm like, wouldn't... If only... Yeah. So for anyone who'd like to ask questions, we've got a microphone in that corner and back and with the Klieg lights. Okay, that's my God.
Okay.
So if you have a question, please feel free to drift on back there. And okay.
Oh, we've got somebody.
Yeah.
We should,
oh, we already have some back there. I'm so sorry. So please go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Lena. You were talking about how the medium of the graphic novel was very useful in expressing certain complicated concepts. I was wondering if there was anything that you wanted to express that wouldn't translate well into a graphic novel or was very difficult to translate into a graphic novel.
The biggest challenge was to make very complex data, very complex information, complex concepts sometimes, more accessible, easier to follow, because we were trying to broaden our audience as much as possible, reach out even to younger people so they understand these things. So the limit was there. How technical do we get? It wasn't in any other. And the biggest for me, is, as far as I'm concerned, the toughest part was to balance out the perfect accuracy, which is journalism, with some a little bit of fantasy, a little bit of a visual poetry and all that. And there was a tension there because I was more interested in the visual, the poetic, and Protab was more interested in the accuracy, and sometimes they clash. So that was the biggest
and each problem. Of these whistleblowers, each of these technologies, you know, could fill a whole book. I mean, Lisa right here, we could write a whole book about her, but we had to kind of include a lot of different... she's shaking her head here. But we had to condense it. And so I do want to mention a couple of things. One is there's a website, viraxcomic.net.org.com, in which we actually have links to all the background stories, to all of these whistleblowers, all of the technologies and things like that. So do check it out. And I did write for my nonprofit, another plug, CorpWatch, a report that you can get online called Drone Inc. You can go to killchain.org. And this is a 92-page report which explains all how the technology works and why it doesn't work. In very dry, well, not so dry detail. So there's a lot that you can't get into a comic book.
The graphic novel is better.
Oh, graphic novel. Yes.
Hi there. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the culture of the organizations actually doing this, the Pentagon, the CIA, and so forth. These are people who seem to be to have perpetrated and are complicit in the greatest privacy rights violation in the history of the world, morally monstrous, cartoonishly evil. Like, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around how terrible these actions are. And I was actually surprised to hear them painted in kind of lighthearted terms of, you know, they're mostly liberal, and it's hard for me to square that with, like, is it just that these people are, they're just following orders? You know, that didn't really...
No, I didn't mean it to be lighthearted or heavy-hearted when I said it. I meant it just to be a factual description of my experience. Bear in mind, when it comes to discussing one's own relatively brief experience in the CIA or any other part of the U.S. government apparatus, I myself am being a little bit like the blind man and the elephant. But I can tell you that most of the people I met there, if you were to ask them about topics like women's reproductive rights or gay equality or whatever, they'd fit right in here in San Francisco. So, which to me makes other elements of the mindset more interesting. I'll say this. We all give ourselves a lot of slack that we don't give to others. This is just human, and if you're curious, Google fundamental attribution error, or sometimes it's called, better called, I think, the fundamental misattribution error, which goes like this. We judge ourselves by our intentions, and we judge others by their actions. That's basically what it is. And you can see a nice example of this in an interview given, I don't know, a year or so ago, a year and a half ago, by Rudy Giuliani, and he was talking about how Syrians were engaging in torture, and by, among other things, waterboarding, and the interviewer, I don't remember who it was, said to him, but what about when Americans do that? And Giuliani said, that's different, because we're Americans. It's almost a punchline, but I think we can assume that he was being sincere, that the fact that something that would otherwise be bad is done by Americans, by some alchemy, renders it as something good. This is actually the best definition I know for American exceptionalism. But it's not unique to America. We all judge others by their actions and ourselves by our intentions, and that's what people at the CIA do. It's why people commit horrific crimes in every war, because of the greater good. You have to. It's a dirty job, but it's for the greater good. Everybody's prey to this kind of mentality, not just at the CIA, not just Americans. We just have more power to abuse the mentality, I think, than most.
People in the military, there are a million or millions of people who work for the military. They all do one tiny little thing. And so they see themselves doing their own job, just as you described. There's a wonderful passage in John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath where this man is losing his farm, and his former classmates come, you know, to take over the farm. And he says, you know, you guys know me. We grew up together. Why are you taking my farm away from me? And they say, well, we may know you, but we work for the bank. And the bank, the machine, is bigger than the sum total of its parts. So I will say, because I have spent a lot of time with the military, not as much with people at the CIA, I will say that they're just ordinary people. Oftentimes, they're young people out of rural America for whom they believe either they need a job, they need to go to college, or they believe in their patriotic vision. And so they don't do this believing that they're going to go out and create an empire. They're doing what they feel is their job. So, I mean, I think in some ways you answered your own question.
Yes, please.
Cool. Hey, guys, I'm David. In 2011, Obama authorized for the first time the targeting of an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki. Mm-hmm. His son was killed in the strike. My question for you, how many years do you think it will be before we see a drone strike on American soil of an American citizen? Thank you.
I wish I had a crystal ball. Maybe not that far down the road. I don't think it would be that, you know, especially if there's, you know, a car chase and, you know, a Hollywood-style thing where there's somebody opening fire. I would say it could be tomorrow, you know.
We already...
It's possible.
Yeah. I agree. If you just look at the pattern, almost every tool and tactic and attitude that is tested overseas in wars winds up drifting back to America. Torture, is a key example. It's one of the reasons that war is so dangerous. It's the blowback. Even if you don't care about the people wars are killing, the way it infects attitudes and the way the technologies come home. Look at the militarization of American police. So yeah, I wouldn't take a bet one way or the other. If it happened tonight, it wouldn't surprise me. Yes, please.
Hi. I work in the field of mental health, and I wanted to understand how the concepts and themes in your book can help therapists or everyday individuals better understand the values and perhaps the personality that our culture is taking form.
So the question was again, could you repeat
how the themes and the concepts reflect the values of the American culture?
I was going to say mental health is actually represented quite a lot in the book because it's about the mental health. A lot of it is about the mental health of the soldiers and the whistleblowers. How does it represent America? I'm not sure that it is a book about U.S. imperialism, but it's not, I would hope it's not a heavy-handed attack on an empire-building project.
It shows both sides. It shows those people within the system who are horrified by what goes on and who are actively trying to stop it. So American values are represented that way. You know, we have whistleblowers who, in my opinion, are the best representation of what America should stand for.
There's a wonderful film called National Bird that you guys should check out. You might be able to watch it on Netflix or something. And it talks about the pain that these whistleblowers go through. And we address it a little bit, but that film does a much better job. I think one of the camera people for the film is sitting right in front of me, too. And it shows, you know, the anguish of these soldiers and their actually applications for mental health support, which eventually the military grants to them. And it's a really compelling tale.
And when you see what happened 2 days ago in Texas, there's never any connection made between this guy was in the military, he's seen some terrible things that we probably will never know, and somehow he kills 26 people. That is a taboo in our media. They talk about what could have possessed him, why was he violent,
we
this
don't
and
know.
That.
Yeah.
But I was neighbors with somebody who had PTSD who came back from Iraq for a while. And the guy just looked like this one. I was saying, oh my God. It seemed, you know, we try to sweep all this under the rug, but it's all around us and people are suffering, not just those people who die over there, but people who were involved in those wars. And as Martin Luther King said so well before he was assassinated, he said these bombs that we drop in Vietnam, they land in the streets of Chicago and New York City and Atlanta because he was seeing the effect of people coming back from the war and completely destroyed, completely traumatized and becoming violent in this country. And also the effect on the budget, you know, all the resources going to wars instead of national health care, education, and all the good things.
Yes, please.
Hi. So today you've spoken a lot about these topics in the American context. I can only assume that other countries around the world have the same issues, both our friends and our adversaries. I'm wondering if you could shed some insight on how these things are operating at sort of the global scale and where you see things going there.
Sure. There are over 100 countries that have access to drones, everything from like the hobby drones, which they use to go and take pictures and things like that, to weaponized drones like the Predator and the Reaper that we talk about in the book. So there is one other country that actively employs these drones, and that's Israel. And they use it actually within their own borders on Palestinians. But there are a couple of other countries that also work in conjunction with the U.S. in the war on terror, and Britain is one. Germany and France certainly participate in this, and of course all of the quote-unquote Five Eyes countries like Australia, New Zealand, and Canada are involved in this. Whether or not they actually say, we want you to kill somebody that we don't like or we think is a terrorist, we don't know. There is an interesting book that's out in French now which says the French government actually requested assistance from the U.S. government to kill several of their own citizens. So this is happening, and of course, we're talking about the U.S. military industrial complex. The drone warfare system is actually a very big system with a lot of moving parts. But actually, you don't really need that kind of technology to be able to do that. I was in Lebanon not too long ago, and Hezbollah has a museum. I went there, and they had a drone on display of their own drone. ISIS has been using drones. There's a man in Japan who put anthrax, de-weaponized anthrax, on a plane and flew it over the house of the Japanese prime minister to make a statement. I don't remember what the statement was. But the statement he made, I think, which is terrifying, is that you can use that to... People use it actually nowadays to drop cell phones and drugs into prisons. Right. It can be used anywhere. And you don't need... I have a drone at home. I could use that. I actually can't operate it. I'm very bad at this sort of stuff. But I do have one. I want to know what it was like, right? And it's available for $100 on the internet.
Buy one on Amazon.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Oh, these are our final two questions.
Thank you very much for your time and insights. So the British have the policy, and correct me if I'm wrong, that unless there's 100% surety that there will be no human collateral damage, they are not going to proceed with a drone strike. Drone strikes that have killed leaders, particularly, case in point, I'm from Pakistan, the leader Mullah Mansoor, and then Osama bin Laden. Do you see value in killing these boogeymen? Do you see value in disentangling the terrorist leadership? And if so, is there a future where we see an exclusive, exclusive set of rules that dictate drone strikes, whereby there is no legal trouble, legally you're fine, the host country has given you permission to initiate the strike, and on top of all that, there is no human collateral damage?
So I think the book actually opens in Pakistan, as we've described. And there's a lot of stuff about Pakistan and Afghanistan there. And it's a good question. I do think, however, that you do need a system of law. So if you're going to use a drone to kill somebody, I think the person needs some system by which they are put on trial. So I don't think you can use this weapon to go after people without actually going through the motions of affording them a right to defend themselves, to legal help, etc. So I personally don't support drone killing in any circumstances. I do not believe that people who were killed, the 6,000 people who killed, there's a lot of statistics out there. People say, you know, well, 5,000 were terrorists and 1,000 were innocent people because they were women and children. I think that's a mistake. I mean, I think you, in this country, in Britain, I'm a British citizen, I was born there, in the Western canon, we believe people are innocent before they're until proven guilty. Thank you. Very remembered. So I think it's really important to have a rule of law. And if you're going to execute somebody, I think you need to think about the blowback from that. I don't think you can just say, this is really going to solve things. In fact, I think it could make the situation worse.
And for politicians like Lindsey Graham, who would respond by saying, but it's a war and we don't have due process on the battlefield, we should probably think about the ramifications of turning the entire war, the entire world for all time, into a war zone, because that's what Lindsey Graham is implying.
And to people like President Donald Trump. You know, do you really want Donald Trump to decide who's guilty? I mean, if you read through the articles that explain how the system works, Barack Obama actually took the final decision on most of these strikes. He was given information, and then he said, okay, I give you the go-ahead to kill somebody. It changed towards the end of his administration, but today that power lies in the hands of Donald Trump, and it will lie in the hands of a future president of France, if they're Marine Le Pen. It will lie in the hands of these people. I think we'll be very careful of giving over power to kill anybody, you know, without a due process and a system of law and justice.
Even if you like the current president.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last question, please.
I'd like to go back a little bit. Right before drones, et cetera, we had this context of lots of terrorist attacks all over the world. We started getting into the Iraq war after 9/11, which was the capstone of those terrorist attacks. People are threatened. We didn't do a great job in Iraq, but the terrorist strikes continue. So the public pressure grows on politicians and military to act. If that were in that context, if you didn't have drones and surveillance at all, what is the likely path our country would have followed? Would we have invaded more countries? Would we have gone to nuclear war? What is the alternative in the absence of this structure? I would like to have that thought experiment, if you could.
You want to answer that?
That's a good question. You know, we worry about... there's been an evolution since the Vietnam War by the government learning all the wrong lessons from Vietnam, learning not to... The lesson for Vietnam was not that we shouldn't be in all these countries trying to dictate our rules. The lesson that they learned was that we shouldn't maybe have a draft anymore. I mean, because too many people are involved, they've got to stop the war. So that's one lesson they learned. The next lesson under Obama was, and Bush and Obama, was there's too much resistance when we send so many Americans there and they get killed. How do we reduce that? So now we're in the drone war scenario where we're trying to kill people without exposing any U.S. citizens, U.S. soldiers. That's considered progress in some certain circles. Is it really progress? The alternative would be maybe, I mean, from our perspective, would be diplomacy. God forbid, diplomacy being fair to other countries. Well, and not just pushing...
I would also say the number of people that died in terrorist attacks, however you define them, whether the guy in Texas or the guy in Las Vegas, if you call them terrorists or not, it doesn't matter, actually is a very small portion of the number of people that die in violent incidents around the world, and particularly in this country where people die every day, every hour from gun violence. You know, so we see people over there as people that are legitimate targets, yet within our own borders, inside our own cities, people are dying every day from guns. So what constitutes terrorism? Somebody picks up a gun and kills their spouse? Is that terrorism? It's a form of terrorism. I mean, we can't answer this all with drones. And I will also say there's a lot of slow ways that people die. There's a drug in America called OxyContin, not the kind of drug that you're thinking of, not pot, not cocaine.
But
this
is a tobacco, drug, actually.
there's tobacco, too, but has killed 200,000 people. And these are done by pharmaceutical companies legally. So if we want to stop killing, we want to stop, you know, the number of people dying in a suicide bomb of somebody's mental health issues is actually quite tiny. And I think the answer is actually in a better healthcare system and a mental health support system than really bombing people all over the world. And, you know, a collaborative dialogue with Pakistan, and a country I've been to many times and really like. I think it's a bad idea for my tax dollars to go to people to kill people in another country. I don't think it really solves anything.
Yeah, it's the, in other words, it's the end of militarism we're looking for. The end of this mentality that if these three guys were killed or 30 guys were killed by a Muslim or a, you know, some kind of enemy, some kind of other, then we have to go to war. It's the only possible answer. Whereas, as Pratap's saying, hundreds of thousands of people are dying of other causes, much more lethal than terrorism. That's not an issue. That's not going to be on the news. It's not going to be a big deal. But we're always itching for some kind of excuse to go and bomb somebody out there. And that brings us back to the military-industrial complex. There's no business like the military-industrial complex.
It's almost like somebody should write a book called, I don't know, War as a Racket, or something like that.
I think that book is out.
No, I'm joking. For those of you who don't know, there is a terrific book called War is a Racket, short book. It's almost a booklet by a World War I decorated military veteran named Smedley Butler. I highly recommend it. It just never changes. Thank you for your questions. We have a tradition here at Inforum Commonwealth Club where our speakers get to opine for 60 seconds apiece on a world-changing idea. So I'm going to ask each of them. Khalil, how about you first? If you had, you've got 60 seconds, what would you propose that would change the world, make the world a better place?
One thing is very simple. I would take money out of politics if I had that power.
That was mine.
Because I would solve so many of the other problems. I mean, and it would be a catch-all, really,
yeah,
for a lot of the problems we suffer from.
Yes.
I would say that, and you know, universal healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. But I actually want to use this opportunity to plug the website for the book, vraxcomic.net.org.com, in which we have actually three things you can do. One, things you can do in 5 minutes to protect your own privacy by using Signal, using Tor, using DuckDuckGo. So things you can do for yourself is one section. There's a second section on the activist groups like the American Civil Liberties Union and Amnesty and people like that you can support and you can work with. And finally, a section on how to leak documents yourself safely without your employers knowing and without even telling the reporters who you are. So please check out the website.
SecureDrop.
SecureDrop and Global Leaks. They're actually two different ways. And we have links to a number of different news organizations from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists big name newspapers and The Guardian, by which you can deliver documents, and they show you how to do it without leaving a trace to yourself. We also put in a plug for the lawyers. You need, Barry's a lawyer. Before you leak any documents, go talk to a lawyer,
please.
That's
when you're starting to like me. All right, great ideas. I got to say again, I loved this book. It is so terrific. It's such a great idea, and it was so brilliantly executed. I highly recommend it. I write thrillers for a living, and I'm telling you, this thing reads like a thriller, a real-life thriller. You'll have a hard time putting it down. I highly recommend it. Khalil and Prothap will be signing copies in the lobby any minute now. Let's give them a big hand. That was a great talk.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Gary.